Mr. Cochrane, Rail 18. Now, you actually left Lerwick on November the 3rd to go to Bridge of Allen in Stirlingshire. Now, what were you doing? This was basically preparing for embarkation. Do you remember much about this period?
It was a very messy period because, first of all, simultaneously, the soldiers were sent off on embarkation leave in about three consecutive batches, but simultaneously the battalion was made up to full strength by other soldiers being drafted in. It wasn't a very good system, I think, because having got a company to know that it needed to be brought up to strength, I agree, but to bring them up to strength at the last minute with in effect total strangers was not the best way of doing it. I don't quite know what else the army could have done, but and in fact, we had too many soldiers. We had to, my company, we had to leave some behind. That was a bit difficult because.
How did you choose them?
Well, there were. Social grounds.
What sort of thing?
Well, family, you know, a new wife or a new baby or something wrong with the wife, some tragedy at home, where in fact it would have been. If it had been possible to avoid it, it would have been unfair to take the chap overseas at that point, certainly, later maybe. The, I remember once or humdrum, private somebody or other, was due to have a complete new set of false teeth, but the army dental service couldn't produce these in time, or we didn't think they would be able to do it, in time for departure. Now, should he be left behind to get his new false teeth, or should he be taken in a bad state of dental health on active service? And again, there were one or two of the new arrivals were patently no good for anything.
In what way?
They. Had you couldn't say they didn't fit in because there's nothing for them. I mean, so many soldiers away on leave, there's nothing for them to fit into. But what was wrong with them was, I think, a sort of feebleness. Soldiers who had obviously loathed, I don't have to blame them there, every minute they'd been since they'd been called up and had been resolved to make the worst of everything that happened to them. And rightly or wrongly, after I think one had something like a week or 10 days to make one's mind up. I talked to Owens about some of these cases, and when I say feeble, I mean ones who had made apparently no effort to accept the fact they'd been called up and make what best they could of the thing, but were in a state of permanent whine, is what all I could say, and so the reason I didn't take them with me is because it's one of the things that's a bad soldier can be made into a better soldier, and if not even a good soldier, a perfectly passable soldier, and a useful soldier. But somebody who, rightly or wrongly, you think is an inveterate whiner is absolutely not the person. He is the bad egg in the clutch. sees the rotten apple. Funnily enough, the chap who is says he's scared to go. Well, A, good. He's honest. It's a good mark. And you can assure him that he's not alone. Everyone's scared. But since everyone is scared, it's something you share. And the scared chap can be helped to be... you wouldn't want him to turn him into a Sir Galahad or a hero, but he could be turned into a perfectly willingly good soldier, or adequate soldier.
Now there was one self-inflicted wound.
Yes, that's the most ruthless thing to do. A chap who had no compassionate reason for being left behind, and he didn't appear to me to be a whiner, but he was determined not to go, and so he put a bullet through his... Well, what he tried to do was put a bullet through his foot. But in fact, he made a mess of it and blew off half his ankle. Well, so he had to be left behind. One of the people who certainly I wouldn't have left behind and didn't, I'm glad I didn't, because he turned out to be absolute trumps, was a Jewish boy, a German Jewish boy from Breslau, who had, with his parents, I think, or perhaps as a child, been sent as a refugee from Germany in about 36 or 7, and he'd been working for a couple of years in Leeds in a factory before he was called up. And I was a bit nervous about him, not about him, but for him, because I sort of said as tactfully as I could, you know, we didn't know where we were going, but we'd be shooting and be shot at by Germans. And was this going to matter to him, since he was German, and or had been German? No, not a bit. He wasn't too fussed about this. And he turned about, I made him a corporal eventually. He was first rate in Italy. Footnote to that, after I published that book, Charlie Company, I got a very nice letter from him. And he was running, I think, an engineering company in the Midlands, Leeds still, I think, not in the Midlands, in Yorkshire. I got a lot of letters from the old soldiers after I published that book. But his was one of the ones that gave me most pleasure.
Now, did you get embarkation leave again after your marriage?
Yes, we got a 5-day embarkation leave. So, as far as I was concerned, I didn't see my wife. That was what? A week and 5 days. Call it a fortnight, if you like. It's two separate dollops. I didn't see her again for another 2.5 years. When we sailed for the Mediterranean on a very crowded troop ship.
Do you remember the name?
No, I...
Doesn't matter.
I can't remember now. Can't remember. And of course, compared to the first trip to the Middle East, this was like a rocket, because it went straight through the Mediterranean. So it had to go all around the... by the Cape of Good Hope. And we landed in Alexandria. We're all sent to a camp near Cairo, near the pyramid, Mina, where we went in for marching, the only thing you could do, really, after sitting around on the boat. But there was a real cock-up, because another ship which had all our battalion transport on it, all the trucks, the few lorries that went with the battalion, the carriers, all that was another ship which went somewhere else. We weren't sure where we'd go. We sent an advance party off to Beirut, and there was some talk we might be sent up to the Lebanon. But in fact, we then heard we were going to go to Italy, and to my great pleasure, we were going to go back to the same brigade, 11th Indian Infantry Brigade, and the same division, the 4th Indian Division, which was in Italy, hadn't been there very long. So that really was the wheel coming full circle again, as far as I was concerned.
Were you nervous yourself about going back into action? You'd had a pretty shocking time last time.
Well, it had been over some time. I mean, that was after all the spring of 1941, and here we were at the very end of the beginning of 1944. But it was January 44, I think, we got from Egypt to Italy. To Taranto. And we were there for a week, I think, or so. I do remember about that. I was really very pleased and sent the whole company off, apart from the sentries and so on, down to the town. I think there was a curfew in the town, but anyhow, strict instructions for me. They had to be back by a certain time. And watch out for the vino. A little of it's good, but don't overdo it. And they all were back on time, and they hadn't overdone it. They may have had a drink or two. Probably didn't like it a bit, as a change from beer or a dram. We were in rather mixed feelings then, because we'd had a Christmas on the boat, and troop ships were really pretty horrible. The officers weren't too badly off, but the soldiers were really in miserable conditions. Then this camp wasn't much fun. Damn cold, as the desert can be if you haven't got. Well, we did have battle dress on, not khaki drill. A pretty cheerless New Year. And nobody quite knew what it was going to be like in Italy. It was a bit disconcerting. However, as I say, I felt that we were in pretty good nick as a company, really for what lay ahead, which was again a hell of a muddle, the casino battle.
So what about the move up to Casino, which you recall?
We went in a train, first of all, so far, which jogged all around the place. More or less a cattle truck train. Going through desolate countryside, because it was a very bad winter. All the hills, even there in the south, were covered in snow. And eventually, from the train, which stopped some way away from Casino, but north of Naples, of course, last part was in three-ton lorries. And we were decanted a little village from which there was a view of Monte Cassino and the famous monastery. Now, the fighting then, such as it was, it was taking place up on the hills above the monastery, and very high hills they were too, partly down below, but it was skirmishing more than fighting, because the low ground was totally flooded. This wasn't by the Germans hadn't sort of opened the dikes, but this exceptionally wet winter, the rivers were flooded, and the low ground between the mountains and the coast was one huge marsh. No, you couldn't operate tanks on it at all. There was no way of going round between Casino and the shore to get round German defences. You had to go for Casino town, for Monte Casino above it, on which the monastery was. And there was not much way of getting round to the other flank, the western side, because the hills just got bigger and bigger and were quite roadless. The Americans were up on top at that time, and the 4th Indian Division relieved, I've forgotten the number of the American division, they were dug in little foxholes in the rocky terrain up near the castle, and they'd been there too long. And in some cases, the GIs had to be actually lifted out of their little foxholes. And they had suffered heavy casualties trying direct assaults on the monastery, which, before we had our turn going up the mountain, we watched being destroyed by the Allied bombers, which was an appalling sight. The effect of the bombing was to turn... It wasn't a very beautiful building. It wasn't the original Benedictine Abbey of the 5th or 6th century. It was a much later one. Even so, it did look very impressive in the winter sunshine, perched on its crag, with the walls of the monastery reaching down into the rocks of the hill so that they blended into one, exactly like photographs one sees of Tibetan monasteries. And it was thought that, well, it was, of course, a perfect observation post. From there, as I learned later when we were up there, you could see everything that moved. Enormous distance on three sides of this pinnacle. The thought that the German observation post there would nullify any attempt, if and when the ground got dry, to make an attack. Therefore, the idea was destroy the observation post. Well, it was destroyed, and it turned the building something that was almost impregnable, because it destroyed it almost utterly. It was just a great heap of rubble. But for soldiers as good as the Germans, a mass of rubble was much better, really, than a normal mountain. They already had the ground near the monastery, the hills that overlooked the monastery slightly. They'd prepared very strong positions, concrete dugouts, mortar emplacements. Further back, they'd worked out their gun emplacements. And, of course, they'd had plenty of time to accurately do their range finding on every possible position that the Allies might have taken up to prepare for an attack. Very, very strong position, and held by a panzer division, if I'm right. Yes, I think I am.
Now, at first, you were on portering, working parties, carrying parties. Could you talk a bit about that?
We had no transport still. We literally were foot soldiers. And so the 2nd Camerons were employed as porters. Now, this was a replay of the problems at Kerin. High, high peaks, a very stiff climb, difficult to get up this the incline with a heavy load. At the top, a well-positioned enemy. If you made a dent on the enemy, you had no further supplies of ammunition, because you couldn't carry them with your own weapons, to hold the position. So the ideal was to have Sherpas, if you like, porters, to follow the leading infantry, humping up more, particularly ammunition. The most battalions relied on their own people to get rations up. And so we were employed on this, and really it was a sort of pretty miserable business, because you were involved in the battle. You couldn't have helped but be involved in the battle. It was flashing and banging, or things blowing up all around one. But you weren't actually doing anything positive. Well, it didn't feel very positive. If the positions had been held even briefly, we could have got more ammunition up. That would have helped. But I don't believe that enough, just as again at Kerin, enough frontline soldiers could have reached the top to hold it. So there's the two different attacks made by the 4th Indian Division, different brigades, neither of which succeeded.
So what happened after the attacks?
Well, we reformed, if you like, back out of the line, at which point actually we had a change of commanding officer, because the company commander, we really said to him, the second in command, that he was no longer fit to command a battalion in battle, which was, if you like, a kind of Paris Revolution. Really, he got the NCO got in such a state of fuss that he really wasn't thinking straight. And in fact, what happened was that he was taken off to hospital. He really was, turned out to be pretty ill. So our second in command, who was a territorial army officer, he took over and was commanding the battalion when we were ordered up on up the hill.
Now, what was his name, the second in command?
Gordon Monroe.
And what was he like?
He was very good. He was a sort of forbidding looking chap in a way, tall, with a big black moustache. He had a very clear mind. He had served with the battalion for a long time. I mean, he'd been there before the departing CO had been appointed. So he knew the battalion well, and more importantly, they knew him. And he commanded us very well over the casino battle at a time when the battalion was only finding its feet. You see that in the Shetlands, the battalion never really had trained for war. There was a battle school. Individual soldiers were fit. They could use their weapons well. A certain amount of training had been done over communications between companies. But since we were the only battalion in the Shetlands, there was no chance of what you might call formation training. And the and really, there was no other battalions to whom to set up proper schemes. We did do, at a company level, training schemes involving live ammunition, but there was never any training on a, if you like, brigade basis, formation basis. So really, this new second battalion, in effect, had to learn on the job. And Cassino was about the worst possible battle for a raw battalion to get battle hardened, because up on the top you had there was a place which you called the bowl, which was a huge something like the Devil's Beef Tub at Moffat, a huge crater, I suppose it had once been. Plenty of room for people to, a whole battalion to be spread around. It was up to the bowl that the mule trains used to come with at night with food and ammunition. From there, mules could be taken forward to the front line positions, but with difficulty, and a lot of it had to be carried, so that a company that was so-called in rest in the bowl was every night humping stuff up to the forward companies. And they were forward because the positions were in fact on a forward slope, so that in daylight any movement was observed from the German positions on a thing called point 593, which was actually a ridge rather than a point, on a long spur, a long ridge that ran to the side of the ruins of the monastery. So if you moved around in daylight, you were inviting sniping fire, and also if there was more than an individual moving around, it brought down heavy mortar fire. And the Germans had really efficient heavy mortars, which in mountain warfare, of course, are vastly more effective than field guns, because they lobbed the projectile up in the air and down on or just behind the opposing ridge. So C Company, we were in one of these forward positions, in fact, I think the most forward of them, in foxholes. I suppose they were the same ones that originally had been dug by the American forces after their failure to capture the monastery.
So you were actually on point 593?
No, point 593 was, we were on a slope
facing
point 593. And in fact, while we were there, there was no question of our having to attack point 593. That had been tried and had failed when we were doing the carrying for the other battalions in the brigade. We were there to literally hold the fort while an attempt was made to clear the low ground below the monastery and to try to get tanks through the road that led through Cassino Town. That was proved impossible because the bombing of the monastery also bombed the town, and just in the way that it had turned the monastery into an ideal defensive position, the bombing had turned the town into one big tank trap. There's no way the New Zealand tanks could get through. But there was fierce fighting in and around the town.